Hello, and welcome to the Bible Made Easy podcast. I'm your host, Kelly, and I'm here to help you understand what you just read in the Bible. Hello, everyone. I am so glad you're on this journey with me. If you are new, welcome. If you have any questions on how the podcast is laid out, you can listen to my introduction episode. And everyone is welcome to go to my website, beamepodcast.com, to drop me a note, ask any question, or just get up to date on the podcast with the resources I have there, including links to all of my pop culture references. Welcome to week 38b. This is Ezra chapters 1 through 6, Haggai, Zechariah, and Esther's chapters 1 through 5. Our timeline is 539 BC to 473 BC. Let's get into it. So, starting in chapter 1 and 2 of Ezra, we finally meet up with Cyrus that not only Jeremiah had told us about, but Isaiah had written about 150 years before Cyrus even came on the scene. Kelly, side note, there were many that believed that Isaiah had been updated and written to include Cyrus and other predictions, but thanks to several archaeological discoveries, including the Dead Sea Scrolls, we know for a fact that Isaiah in its full was written 150 years before Cyrus and 700 years before Christ. But as we just read, Cyrus does allow for the people to go back to Jerusalem after they had been in captivity of Babylon for 70 years. Cyrus declares that God has told him to build a temple in Jerusalem for God and allows the exiles to go back to live and help build it. He even releases all the items that Nebuchadnezzar had taken in the beginning of the exile. And then we read a list of all the people who returned, their original tribes, and where they had been exiled to. In Zechariah chapters 1 through 2, Zechariah has a dream about what is going to come about rebuilding the temple and the favor that would be handed to them, that it was time to leave Babylon and return to Jerusalem where God would be with them the whole time. In chapter 3, we see how Joshua, as the high priest, was chosen and restored to his rightful place as the priest in Israel and how God would use him. In chapter 4, we see where God is going to appoint Zerubbabel as a leader over Israel to take them back to Jerusalem. In chapter 5, we see that God has given Zechariah a new vision of problems that would be coming their way as they moved from Babylon to Jerusalem. First, that the Ten Commandments would be coming back, which is the law that would be over the land. This is the scroll. And those who disobeyed would be punished. Then, the wickedness and habits and thoughts picked up from the Babylonians would need to be banished and sent back to where it started, Babylon. There is no place for that in God's kingdom. Kelly, side note, for chapter 6, there's a lot of commentary out there. But based upon everything I've read in the Bible and the brains of those much smarter than myself, I go with the conclusion that the reason Joshua, even though he was a head priest and wasn't king like Zerubbabel, it is because he does have someone coming in his line, Jesus. And Jesus would be crowned not only king for us, but our high priest, which also makes a lot of sense when we see the prophecy talking about the branch, which we will get into in the New Testament when we see Jesus is that branch. All right. Chapter 7, we see that God requires obedience, justice, and mercy, not the religious requirements that have been set up by man. We are to follow what God says, not the rituals that have been set up as people. This would need to be understood, especially as the people would give up their rituals they had in Babylon for the rules of God and his temple. Chapters 8 through 11 are God's promise to Jerusalem, Judah, and what God will do to the enemies of Jerusalem as they keep his covenant. This is not only true for the time, but will be for the future, as many of the passages in chapter 11 are about a future time, such as when the Romans take over Jerusalem. If you want to go back to how the future lays out, you can go back to the earlier episode and read all through Daniel, chapters 10 through 12. In fact, at the end of chapter 12 in Zechariah, we see God telling Zechariah about the mourning for the one they pierce, which without a doubt is Christ. And then in chapter 13, we see what happens to Christ and his disciples as they were scattered when their shepherd is struck. But they were refined with the fire of the Holy Spirit and became bold in their faith. In chapter 14 is more about the end times, which will become more clear once we get to the New Testament and especially the book of Revelation. So in Ezra 3 and Haggai gets word from the Lord that it is time to build. Some people were a bit slow to act, especially having now been used to living in exile. But God's like, this is not how it's going to go down. You need to be rebuilding the temple and praising me. So Haggai told this to Zerubbabel and Joshua, and they were like, you got it, God, let's go.
the first thing the people do is to start offering sacrifices to God based upon the laws that had been set up previously in the Law of Moses. It laid out how they were to be done, and that is exactly what the people do. We see in Haggai 2 that the Lord reminds through Haggai what the sacrifice is supposed to be and how to consecrate the sacrifices that they are to give. Then, once they had done that, they gave their money to the masons and carpenters, and with food and drink to Sidon and Tyre, so they could get the cedar logs from Lebanon to rebuild the temple. You got to use a currency people want, and food and drink is universal. And then once the foundation was laid for the temple, everyone praised and shouted for the Lord and celebrated a la King David, which, compared to how we last left Jerusalem, this was a breath of fresh air. And Ezra 4, of course, with good things come the haters, and unfortunately, they didn't have Taylor Swift shake it off on blast to put them in their place, but they did have something way better, and that's God. And because they are good haters, they first came to the Jews with the old, "Let us help you because we are just like you." And God gave discernment to Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the heads of the family. And they're like, "No, no, this is between God and us, and we alone will do it." Then, because the haters totally did not like that answer, they set out to discourage the people. And then they started bribing officials to make it difficult to do the job, and in general did everything they could to frustrate the plans of Israel to rebuild. Kelly, side note, please note that the exact plan of discouragement is one that Satan has used before. He used it this time, and he is going to use again. It is nothing new, but it is incredibly effective, and that is why it's still used today. So if you're feeling discouragement, I encourage you to get into the Word of God and tell Satan where he can go, because guess what? That's where he's going to end up, and he knows it, and that's why he's mad. So, back to Ezra. Then, when Xerxes is in Persia, took over, and later his son, stepson to Esther, Artaxerxes, they started using them as well for the vile purposes, because of course the haters did. And don't you just love that the Bible keeps its receipts? Because we still have the letters those asshats sent to Artaxerxes and his response. So, for a moment, the work on the temple was paused. In Ezra 5, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah prophesied over Jerusalem and the construction of the temple resumed, and thanks to our earlier read, we know all what was said and revealed. However, Tattenai, the governor of the area, was like, "Who said you could do this?" And they did not respond because they were waiting on their letter from King Darius. And in Ezra 6, we once again get receipts of the letters. And sure enough, Cyrus had dictated that the Jews could go back and rebuild. And so King Darius was like, "Not only will you not stop them, but their expenses will be paid out of the royal treasury so they can do what has been decreed. And if any of you try to stop it, we will pull a beam from your home and impale you on it." Period. And then they were able to celebrate Passover in Jerusalem. I can't even imagine what the vibe there was like. I bet it was just an infectious feeling of joy and celebration of all that God had done and the wonder of it all, and just to get back to how everything should be. I have no doubt that is part of the feeling we'll have in heaven. Then we get to Esther. Oh, I love this book. The book of Esther is so much fun to read. I don't think there is much that needs clarifying in this book, so I will keep this mostly my commentary. First note that the book of Esther does happen between the time of Ezra chapter 5, but before chapter 6. And we do meet Xerxes, yes, the same from the movie 300, clearly not the brightest crayon in the box. And it is only in the book of Esther that he makes me giggle, as it reads a lot like a rom-com. So Queen Vashti is moved out of the palace, divorced for all intents and purposes because she refused to dance nude for her belligerent husband and his distinguished guests. Oh, side note, disgusting guests. That's what they were. So go Queen Vashti. Now, once the king sobers up, he clearly has to find a new queen because he got rid of her. And that is when we meet Mordecai and his niece Hadassah, who will change her name to Esther to not be found out as Jewish. Of course, the king falls for her and they are married. Then we meet the hated villain, who again is an asshat, named Haman, who is a wannabe and very much is a brown-nosing simp. We've met people like him. We've even had managers like him. We know is this type, and it isn't cool now, just like it wasn't cool then or 1,000 years ago. And you want to talk about being anti-Semitic? This dude hates Jews and wants to destroy all of them. And unlike most people, you can really compare him to his much later 1930-1940 German counterpart. Anyway, unfortunately, this man persuades Xerxes, who again isn't the brightest, to go along with his plot. But the ever-wise Mordecai hears about it and gets in touch with Esther, who had very much been kept in the dark at this point, and also found out that she hadn't seen the king for like a month now. That's not very romantic, King Xerxes. Anyway, Mordecai tells her that she's going to have to stop it. And at first, homegirl is afraid, which is completely understandable. It could cost her her life. But as her uncle reminds her, your life may be spared in this one instance, but you will die. And then makes the famous statement, and who knows, but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. And of course, this hits Esther in the feels, as it does for me too, and says, you're right. I will do this. I need you to pray and fast with me because it is against the law what I'm about to do. And if I perish doing it, I perish. And then, after the 3 days, Esther enters the presence of the king without invitation. However, her king was like, look at you. I love you. What do you want, pretty girl? And she's like, hey, I would love to have a banquet with you and Haman. And of course, Xerxes is like, whatever you want, beautiful. Then Haman finds out and was like, all right. And he gets ready to go. Before that, though, he notices that Mordecai is there, doesn't bow to him, and is just utterly offended by this. Shocking. And so he tells his Haman tells his wife, that dude ain't living much longer. And in fact, he makes a pole in his yard that he is going to hang Mordecai on. I repeat, asshat. Anyway, that is where we end today. So if you have any reactions, thoughts, questions, or words you need to throw my way, please do so at my website, bmepodcast.com. Have a most fabulous week, and I'll talk to you in the next episode.